Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Brian Collins, and we are going to be discussing The Wanderer by Fritz Leiber, which won the 1965 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So hi there, Brian. Welcome.
Hey, Seth. I know I'm not like the first person to have this feeling, but it's so weird to be here because I've listened to the podcast before, but now I'm actually like in an episode and just in time too for like one of the last episodes. I almost missed it.
Yep. No, it's not at all an uncommon thing that I hear where people are like, oh, I've listened to it and it's weird to hear you do the intro with me on the line.
And now I have to respond to it.
Yes, absolutely. So why don't you tell my listeners about yourself, about your nerdy history and your interests and that kind of stuff.
So, like he said, I'm Brian. I've been a fan, I guess, in like the, you know, as proper a sense of a word as you can get for only like a couple years now. But I've been into science fiction for way longer than that. I mean, I got into science fiction through movies mostly. I was a late bloomer when it came to reading. I didn't start like reading as like a thing you do for pleasure until I was in seventh or eighth grade. And I started reading like Michael Crichton novels, which at some point I'll get back to those because I'm curious as to how The Andromeda Strain and like Sphere hold up because I have no clue. I haven't read them since I was a teenager, but
yeah,
those are my first tastes of, you know, SF literature for adults. But before that, I watched just like one of the first movies that I remember watching was Jurassic Park, which it was on VHS. I was too young to have seen it in theaters. I wasn't born yet, but when I was like 3 years old, which in hindsight is crazy. You really shouldn't show a three-year-old Jurassic Park. There are certain parts that'll scare them, but I mean, I guess I was fine. I was too dumb to be scared, I guess, but
there we go.
I mean, I loved it. I've never gotten off of it. I've written like a couple pieces about it on like a couple sites. I might do a piece for my own site, which I'll talk about in a second, but
yeah,
for movies. And, I think my, given my age, I guess this sounds weird, but I always had like a fixation on 50s SF specifically. Like for my own site, I tried to not play favorites when it comes to when, you know, the time period that I review stuff from, but I kind of gravitate around the 50s. I blame The Iron Giant for that more than anything, which again, I watched just almost nonstop on VHS back when I was a little kid. And then I got into, you know, Godzilla, which is another thing, and Ray Harryhausen movies. And I had this one VHS tape that was, oh God, it wasn't even a movie. It was a compilation. It was called Fantastic Dinosaurs of the Movies, which is misleading because like it's not even about dinosaurs most of the time. It's basically a compilation of trailers of monster movies from like the 50s through the 70s. And that's how I got introduced to, you know, Godzilla and Rodan and, you know, kaiju films in general, and also some just really trashy, not good American productions. Like, God, the giant Gila monster is one of those like late 50s monster movies that's really boring that I didn't actually watch until I was much later. But I grew up with like the imagery of monster movies in my head. So that was kind of my first reference point. And, you know, I've come a long way since then, but I still have a soft spot for B movies. So I'm trying to think. So my site, Remembrance of Things Past and Future, which is kind of a verbose title, but I'm really bad with titles. I couldn't come up with anything more precise at the time, more concise at the time. I started it last summer. It was July. And so, yeah, it's almost a year old now. And I post every few days. And usually it's a review of a short story or novella. It's usually short fiction because like the prospect of reviewing whole novels at a time kind of daunts me.
Understood.
Which is kind of what we're doing today. So yeah. I'm sweating, you know, but specifically I focus on science fiction and fantasy and also, you know, like supernatural horror that was published in the magazines. And it doesn't have to be like, you know, the genre magazines like Astounding and Asimov's. It can occasionally be something like the Saturday Evening Post. If I find something that's, I think, interesting, if I think I can like write about it, then, you know, I'll see if I can get through it.
Yeah. Yeah, you kind of it can be easy to stereotype like old science fiction as just pulps, but there's a lot of the more kind of legit magazines like Collier's and even Playboy that published a lot of quality stuff.
Well, if you read stuff by Richard Matheson or Charles Beaumont, those guys, a lot of their short fiction was in Playboy first. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't. Sometimes it'll be like in, you know, the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, but they were, because they knew where the big money was. They wanted to be printed in Playboy or even like Rogue or like later on even Penthouse. Mm. Kind of the, if we're to be like polite about it, the men's magazines, but but also Collier's and like the Slicks, you know, from the 50s. But you know, again, it's not just like the trashy genre magazines, Planet Stories and so on. Yeah. Not that they didn't have good stuff. Obviously they did, but they knew where the money was.
Yeah. So you don't really know where your interest in kind of retro science fiction comes from?
Well, like I said, it's like, you know how like when you're like a very young kid and you see certain stuff that for no particular reason kind of like imprints on you?
Mm-hmm.
It's like when I watched the Iron Giant over and over again as a kid. And granted, that's a movie from the late 90s, but it's about, you know, it's kind of this nostalgic but also critical portrait of 50s pop culture.
Right.
You know, the space race and comic books, Superman, and again, B-movies, which were in the late 50s were just like, they were just being produced nonstop.
Yeah. Well, like on the last episode that I did for Shadow Over Mars, I mentioned that like those, the old-timey science fiction that imagines lush ecosystems on Venus and Mars, I just find that very charming. And it, you know, it's an earlier kind of view on things, but I really like it.
It is charming. I mean, it's unscientific, but that kind of thing doesn't bother me really. I'm actually in the middle of, not Shadow Over Mars, but another Lee Brackett novella, Enchantress of Venus, which I'm actually going to be writing about pretty soon.
Oh, awesome.
And it, you know, it's one of those Brackett stories where Venus is a huge swamp, which even in the late 40s, they must have known was bogus, right?
Yeah.
There's no way that people would take it seriously on a scientific level, but it's still a good setting for adventure writing.
Mm-hmm. Lots of times, you know, I ask, you know, why are we discussing this book? As I've gotten shorter and shorter on the list, it becomes, I usually kind of find someone and tap them and say, hey, you look like you'd be a good person for this, because I think I had seen you post several reviews of Fritz Leiber.
Yeah, I did actually. Back in December, because Fritz Leiber was born on Christmas Eve. He's one of those authors who in the past couple of years I've really taken liking to. And it's weird because I don't think I had read a single word of him prior to college, but I got introduced to his short fiction through like a couple of anthologies that I started collecting. And as a short story writer, he's great. I mean, from if we're talking 50s and 60s, even comparing to like the new wave writers, at short lengths, I think he's pretty dependable. His novels are kind of hit and miss.
Okay.
I really like The Big Time. I know you weren't big on.
Yeah, it didn't really work for me. So,
but a lot of people don't like it, actually. You're not really alone on that. But I think it's pretty neat. And I also reviewed his short novel, Destiny Times 3, which is an earlier novel, which itself is pretty uneven. It is pretty fascinating, though, especially because it was written right before the dropping of the first atomic bomb. And I kind of, to make it short, I kind of have to wonder how Leiber would have written it differently if he wrote it like a year or two later. But
yeah,
it's a bit of a trip. It's not totally cohesive. The character work is not as strong as in some of his later fiction. But again, I kind of recommend it. And I've also read Conjure Wife, the magazine version, which is shorter, but as far as I can tell, the magazine and book versions are substantially more or less the same.
They are. Yeah, I read both when we covered it for Take Me to Your Reader.
Yeah, I read the magazine version because I didn't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
I could just read a scan of it without worrying about buying a used copier.
Yeah, exactly.
I almost read The Wanderer, actually, because it is on the Internet Archive. You can you know, quote unquote, rent it and, you know, read it without paying for it. But
okay,
I realized that it was a British edition and I didn't want that. I wanted American or nothing.
Gotcha.
So I actually went out and bought a used coffee. Used coffee. What am I thinking? I still don't know if it was worth it, but I mean, it was cheap. So I guess it was, it had to be worth it. Right.
Sure. Did you happen to tally up your Hugo count?
So I got 46.
Okay.
It's either 45 or 46. I don't know if I want to count the mule, because I'm pretty sure, if memory is right, it's part of Foundation and Empire.
Yes.
It's a good chunk of that novel, which is kind of weird. I'm pretty sure it's a novella, but it's like really short, but I don't know if I like want to count that, because I didn't read the mule on its own, but I read Foundation and Empire. So I guess I'll count it.
I can tell you, I did the same thing. So, and I counted because it really is just half of that book.
Yeah. It is like half of what is already kind of a short novel. But yeah, 46, and it skews older, you know, 50s, 60s, and 70s. Once we get to the 2010s, I'm pretty bad at it. Honestly, I've read two novels from the 2010s that are Hugo winners.
Yeah. You know, I want to ask this, and then, you know, we can always decide not to keep it. I sent out a survey recently where people could send questions in, and one of the questions that came in was, you know, what I think about 40s and 50s science fiction and if it will endure. And for all I know, you sent this question in. but somebody like asked that and said, you know, will the new wave, will all this stuff endure and be still being read in 50 years, 100 years? And so I was curious, you know, as somebody who is attracted to the older science fiction, your thoughts on that.
So I have mixed feelings about the new wave, because when I started reading classic science fiction, I mostly actually stuck to seminal works from, you know, the new wave and post-new wave period from like the late 60s to the 70s. You know, Philip K. Dick, you know, Liggins, The Left Hand of Darkness, The World for World is Forest.
Yeah.
But that's also kind of unfair, because especially at short fiction lengths, because I honestly read short fiction more often than novels these days. The new wave has seen its own pretty brutal aging process. I had started reading The Best from Orbit, which is this anthology collecting what Damon Knight considers like his favorite stories from the first 10 volumes of Orbit, which is this new wave anthology series he edited. And some of the stories are good, but some are just kind of nonsense and like not in a fun way.
Right.
It's like, you know, literary experimentation for the sake of itself. And it's not fun. And this can be kind of summed up even in like, cause you've already reviewed for the podcast, Farmers to Your Scattered Bodies Go, right? The first River World novel. I kind of like Farmer sometimes, but he can also be in kind of like, I think the worst of the new wave habits. He can also just be kind of, boring and pointless, which sounds a bit harsh, but when he's good, I actually think he's a lot of fun, but then there's times where he's not. And I don't think that would have been the case if not for the leeway that, like, you know, the lifting of censorship standards during the new wave gave.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of part of my thinking about this. I've been trying to think about an answer to that question is, you know, when you look at the 40s and 50s stuff, it's influential enough that I feel like people continue to read it just because the genre is in conversation with itself. And with the new wave, like, there's progress that's made through when there's shifts in what gets published. And so, you know, you end up with, well, all of a sudden you have books that have female characters that are actual characters, and that kind of stuff sticks. And so even if the style doesn't stick, a lot of the progress that's made does, which is cool.
Yeah. But again, this is an exaggeration, right? Because if you actually look at at short lengths, novels is a bit of a different story, but at short lengths, there were unquestionably more female authors who were active in the 50s than in the following decade. I mean, the big narrowing of the magazine market really like caused a lot of female authors to kind of, you know, search other avenues, right?
Yeah.
Or in some cases like Lee Brackett, Margaret St. Clair, they turned mostly to novels. But again, they were never as prolific as they were before.
Yeah, I guess I don't really think about it from the publishing aspect of it, but that's interesting.
But yeah, so you asked on Twitter people who might be interested in covering The Wanderer for the podcast, and I'm not sure how many people responded. I don't think it was many.
No.
It was... I think I was the first to respond. I just jumped at the opportunity because I was... Yeah. Honestly, I was morbidly curious about this novel for a while, having read enough of what I think is Leiber's good stuff.
Yeah.
And The Wanderer, you know, from the few people who still talk about it, has not a good reputation.
True.
Deservedly. Mm-hmm. But it is actually the first Hugo winner to be published in paperback originally.
Right.
Which typically with book publishing, you want to get a hardcover deal first and then later the paperback edition, you know, if you want to be taken seriously. But then The Wanderer was a paperback original, which may have been a bad omen, but still it was the first. And it was actually the last Hugo winning novel from the 60s that I hadn't read. So with this, my 60s run was totally finished.
Yeah,
I read everything else. Yeah, well, that goes without saying. But like, if we talk like the 60s Hugo winners, it's a pretty solid lineup. I mean, everything here is either famous and like respected, or it's not as famous, but people generally still like it, right?
Yeah, if you just look at like the bookmarks on either side of The Wanderer, you have Dune and Waystation.
Dune, Waystation, and even Zelazny's... And Call Me Conrad, which is more obscure. People still, I mean, it has a Library of America edition. People still like that novel. Yeah. And then you have The Wanderer, which no one talks about.
Yeah. Yeah. At some point I was like, is this a good one to leave for the end? Or is this one we should have covered earlier? But I don't know. The more I think of it, the more I am glad that I didn't go through in publication order of the Hugos, just because I liked being able to get views from different decades and not getting bogged down. Not that I think I would have gotten bogged down, because like you said, the 60s have some pretty strong titles in there. But to me, like The Wanderer is a clear step down from things like Dune and Waystation and Call Me Conrad.
I mean, it's a step down pretty much no matter where you place it on the timeline, but it's especially jarring because it's surrounded by like such beloved, you know, examples of the genre.
Well, and so it sounds like we've started moving into the kind of overall thoughts on this book and kind of moving into the non-spoiler discussion. This was a first-time read for both of us, and that is not super common, but it's not uncommon when it's one where I reach out and ask for people to volunteer for particular books. You know, you're more experienced with Leiber, and you said like The Big Time was something that you liked quite a bit more. I didn't love The Big Time, but I liked it better than The Wanderer, I can tell you that. And for one thing, The Big Time was shorter. And
oh, yeah, it's again, it's basically, yeah, The Big Time, it's basically a novella, right? It barely makes it past the, I guess, the 40,000 word mark that would like be the cutoff. And The Wanderer is not short. It's not long by modern standards, but it's not, it feels longer than it is.
Exactly. I was going to say that exact same thing. Go ahead.
I guess it makes sense that it was a book original because, well, as you know, Conjure Wife was originally in Unknown. It was the lead novel for that magazine. Mm-hmm. The Big Time was a two-part serial. And usually with novels that are serialized, they can only be so long. I mean, Dune, which was considered like this titan, like this real chunky book at the time, it was two serials.
Right.
Like for a total of 8 parts, which is a lot.
Yeah.
And The Wanderer, if it was published in a magazine, it'd probably be 5 parts, which was kind of unusual. And I'm not even sure who would have taken it at the time because of the quality of the book, but also it's a bit raunchy. It doesn't go too far in that regard, but it's for like a kind of just before the new wave, it is a bit it's a bit dirty, right?
Yeah. I don't see this one working at all in serialization just because of how, I don't want to say peripatetic, you know, how much it hops around between different character viewpoints. And I think if in serialization, you would completely lose the thread of what's going on, which honestly, I struggled with anyway.
I think I lost the thread just reading it towards the end, just because, again, there are so many threads and a lot of them don't do anything ultimately.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the, and kind of moving into those overall thoughts is I did not have a great time reading this one. And one of the main problems with it is it's on paper. This is a book that I think I would like. It's essentially like a disaster movie. And lots of times in, you know, you think of something like The Poseidon Adventure, where it's this small group of people trying to escape this terrible situation. And you have that in The Wanderer. And then you also have like nine other small groups of people doing various things. And I didn't really care about any of them. And that's a problem.
I didn't even remember half of them. But
yeah.
But again, the frustrating thing about this novel before you even start reading it is that if you were to give an elevator pitch for like...
Right, which I guess I did skip that part.
for like the basic plot, right? And this is a disaster novel. It's also a big dumb object story.
Yes.
Right? It starts with an eclipse because the Wanderer, which is this planet... that has been dislodged, perhaps intentionally, from some distant solar system, comes, you know, kind of crashing into ours and actually blocks out the sun at one point. Mm-hmm. It is so big that it actually dwarfs Earth's moon, and it literally tears the moon apart.
Right.
And that's kind of the cause of most of the problems for the human characters, just trying to survive the natural, which, to be fair to Liber, it is a logical thing to happen. It's like, oh, you take you tear them into pieces. Oh, the oceans are going to be, you know, hell, basically.
Right. Well, yeah, and something that size as well, more or less supplanting the moon. You get all kinds of weird tidal forces and tsunamis and earthquakes, and to say nothing of tides.
Yeah, the tidal forces is actually kind of amazing that worse doesn't happen.
Right. Well, but at some point you have people in essentially a skyscraper where the water is halfway up.
Yeah, it is basically, I'm thinking of Larry Niven's Inconstant Moon, where it's kind of a quasi-apocalyptic situation, where literally like half the world dies.
Yeah.
And, but the real catch with the Wanderer is what's not really inside the Wanderer itself. They come in literal flying saucers, right? Like out of a B-movie, the aliens that are with the Wanderer, the elephant in the room with this novel.
Yes.
the how do I describe this without sounding the telepathic furry beatniks that are they're cat people, and on the sliding scale of cat versus humanoid, they're human shaped, but they are entirely furry. They're basically cats if they were like our size and bipedal and they could talk, which causes some very awkward scenes, that we're going to get to later we have to, oh God, what do I,
yeah, I'm having that exact experience right now, Brian.
The Wikipedia page gives you a list of characters, which doesn't help you much because a lot of these people are literally like one note, right? So to like list things off a bit, this includes, but is not limited to, a trio of friends, you know, two of whom are engaged. They're separated, all three of them, for most of the novel. So it's kind of easy to forget that they know each other. But you also have this society of kind of quacky saucer people, you know, people obsessed with UFOs.
Who are looking at a lunar eclipse, right?
The eclipse towards the beginning. And they have like assigned nicknames such as the Ramrod and the Little Man in capital letters.
Yeah.
And you also have elsewhere, you have like three stoners in Harlem who don't do anything. You've got a female adventurer, I think in Florida, who the way she's written, I feel like maybe a parody of something.
Maybe.
It's hard to tell because this is not a funny book, even though it tries sometimes, but. You also have, like, you know, people who are stuck in the ocean when the Wanderer comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Like this Welsh poet. Well, God, what was his name? Was it?
Oh, he was insufferable.
Wolf Loner?
Yes.
That can't be. That, but it is, I think. It's Wolf Loner.
And it's Di Davies.
Di Davies.
Yeah. Wolf Loner is the sea adventurer guy, right?
The sea There was this another, Oh God, he has a name that is supposed to be, I think, vaguely East Asian sounding. I don't want to repeat it. It's so
I can say it. And I have no idea how realistic Bagong Bung is as
Bagong Bung.
Yes,
that's his name.
Yeah, I'm like, is that supposed to be like Vietnamese or Thai? I don't know.
I think it's supposed to be Vietnamese, yeah. But it's hard to tell, and there's no way to make it sound good.
Yeah.
There's another character who, in the subplot with the female adventurer, who's kind of written in a weird way, he has a long name, that Liber, because he thinks he's being really funny. He usually shortens it to a certain set of initials.
Yes.
And it's what we would call racial humor that would probably not pass muster.
Right.
And with modern readers.
With several black characters.
With several black characters who aren't even, they're like one dimensional.
Yeah.
Which is most of the characters, to be fair. But
again,
it does not look good.
Well, and even at the beginning of the book, in the first chapter, he essentially, the omniscient narrator says, we could have started this by following any number of people. And then it literally lists like 17 people.
It literally lists the characters and like kind of sums up their different subplots, which.
And I read that and I was like, oh, this is not good that he's doing this. I'm like, because he's naming people who might be more interesting than the people we're actually going to follow. And then I thought, we're actually going to follow Margot and Paul and Dawn. But then it turns out, no, we follow all of them. And not to any
great length. And of course,
You
know, we have Paul, Don, Margo, of course, the best character, Meow, the cat.
Again, cats are people.
Cats are people. They say that several times.
And then Ron Howard says, they are not.
They are not.
Yeah.
We don't know what they are, but they are not people. Oh God, the thing with cats.
Yeah. I'm not a cat person. And so I literally wrote down cat book. Ugh.
A book that, I mean, granted, this is a Liber thing generally. He's clearly a cat person.
Yeah.
Not knocking him for that. I'm just saying that with this particular novel, he really zeroes in on, I guess, what must have been a meme among SF fans at the time, which is basically that, oh, cats are aliens.
Right.
Right. Or in the Heinlein sense of kind of worldview, they're basically women. Right.
Right. Right.
which are, you know, the misogyny, we could get into that, but
and the big question, will it sex?
Oh, it does.
Yes.
I don't want to give it away now, but it does.
No.
Just so that the listeners know in advance that there is that.
Yeah.
And other things.
Yeah. Boy, I'm struggling with how to actually
articulate.
Yeah, to articulate anything. And so I think at this point, let's just flip over to spoilers and we can talk about whatever we want to.
Basically, yeah, we should do that because what is
the other groups of people you have Sally Harris and Jake Lesher, who are just insufferable artsy people in New York who see this disaster where it's obviously going to result in hundreds of thousands of deaths. And all they can think is, let's find a comfy place to go.
To
do the sex and to write a play. And just like every time it switched back to them, I'm like, oh, next, you know, I wanted to just flip away.
I think mentally I blacked out after a period whenever it like shot back to them, or basically any character who kind of falls past the threshold of being annoying, which after a point becomes kind of hard because it just leaves large blank spots. With this
I'm
novel.
Looking forward to Hugo Girl covering this book just because of the number of descriptions of breasts as baked goods.
Oh, they're going to have a quote unquote fun time with this one.
It'll be wonderful. Yeah.
It'll be fun for us, but
yes,
it will not be fun for them to read. No.
And you know, there's also the stoners. I felt like, is this racist?
I
couldn't really decide because there's not a ton of description about the various characters other than they're smoking weed constantly, which causes them to be paranoid, run from the police into a subway station, and drown. And it's almost – I was like, is this supposed to be funny?
And again, they don't contribute anything to the grander picture of what's going on.
Yeah. And yeah, this is my main problem with the novel. Is like I was interested in what was happening with Dawn. He was on the moon. You know, the moon is undergoing some problems. He gets ordered to take off and, you know, take a look at the Wanderer. Meanwhile, the moon breaks in half and he flies down through the core of it. And I thought, okay, that's exciting. That's cinematic. I'm enjoying that. So that part I was interested in. Paul and his discussions with Tiger Ishka, of course, because why not?
We're going to be talking about Tiger Ishka for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe we'll save that. But yeah. It was at least interesting. It held my attention.
Liber can actually, I mean, this is more apparent if you read like his Fafhrd and Grey Master stories, but he can actually write action pretty well. All too sparingly in this novel, which is weird given the spectacle of it, but there are little hints of actually good writing in here.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even really want to talk about the rest of the characters. There's like the two military people who hate each other, but
the angry top military guy where he's lusting after his coworker, but she makes it very clear that she's a lesbian and like, I guess in fairness, he is pretty roundly humiliated.
Yeah.
Like he's clear like a huge, he's not a good guy.
No.
So there's that. But again, why?
Well, the water's coming and we're going to drown. So we may as well, you know, get it.
Try our luck, right? I mean, what's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
Getting hugely emasculated, which also happens with Paul, but under different, I guess, less dire circumstances.
Yes.
Oh, Paul. No.
Well,
wait.
So I'm trying to look for the positive and see like what was Liber going for in this book? Because a lot of these characters, like we talked about Begong Bung, right? If you take all of his parts and you string them together, I mean, it's a few pages in the book, right?
It is like 10 pages. Yeah, probably.
Like 10 pages. And so I'm like, you know, get rid of that one. You know, I don't know why we need to know what's going on over there. Other than it kind of gives a more global perspective. But like I said, I would have preferred it to be a little more intimate, focus on one of them. Like if I was going to do a film adaptation of this, I'd focus on like Margot and Paul and Dawn.
If I was for some reason forced to write a screenplay adapting this novel, I would just toss half of it out.
Yeah.
It's not a long novel, but if you cut out at least 100 pages, the overall narrative would not suffer.
Yeah.
Like with the main trio, because that's really what the meat of the book is. But you also have all this extra stuff that's thrown on. And it's funny too, because I'm actually in the middle of rereading Stand on Zanzibar, which actually does this kind of thing well.
It does. Yeah.
I guess my gripe with Stand on Zanzibar is actually, I wish there was less of the core plot, which is already kind of peripheral if you think back on it, but like Brunner is so much better at making you feel like this, like giving this, you know, again, global sense, like the world is a real place as depicted in the novel. It feels three-dimensional. Liber does not do that despite all the characters. Like again, still one-dimensional. It's just, there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
But why did Liber write the novel? Now that was a good question.
Right. And yeah, that's what I was going for in terms of like, there's some stuff where I feel like, okay, is this making the obvious point that I think it's making, where at the end, you know, you find out that the Wanderer are space hippies, who are nonconformists, right?
Like I said, they're furry beatniks.
Yeah.
The hippies would not really have been a thing yet, but clearly Liber knew about the beatniks and it messed with them seriously because he...
And down to the emblematic nature of the Wanderer being colorful, purple and yellow, whereas then the Stranger comes in, which is the police, essentially, and it's just dead gray, right?
Who I guess are supposed to be the bad guys, but the people on the Wanderer are so careless and like crass with like other life forms that it's like it's really hard to root for them. It's like
maybe they lose their case, right?
They lose their case, which again I suppose is supposed to be framed as like, you know, a bad thing, but it's like, you know, maybe these people should be in jail. That's the least we can do.
Come over here and talk about how I treated you basically well and fed you and stuff, and don't mention any of the stuff about the millions of people dying on Earth.
Just, you know, passively, right?
Yeah. But like with the contrast between the gray Stranger and the colorful Wanderer, I thought, okay, is this making some thing talking about societal nonconformists and, you know, being pressed into to just be normal, right? Or like, is there a LGBT reading of this? But then the stuff on the Wanderer completely undercuts that, because when Paul is initially up there and he's a little hot for teacher with Tiger Ishka, and she thinks that Meow is the one thinking those thoughts, and thinks literally, oh, but don't think those thoughts, we're both girls, you know? So they're like rigidly heteronormative.
Okay. So, okay. We have to talk about that scene now, yes. I guess, cause you brought it up. Yeah. I was going to bring it up at some point, cause this was the scene a little over a third into the novel where, my hope died, right? Yes. Where there was no going back. So the first scene with Tiger Ishka, again, they're telepathic, but for some reason she could not figure out at first where, like, the horny thoughts were coming from.
Right.
She thought it was from Meow at first. And again, she does say the thing where she's like, oh, you're too small. And also, we're both girls.
Right.
And I was like, but... And then she notices it's coming from Paul, which...
Right.
I would also be embarrassed if that happened, but mm-hmm. that's on him, right?
Right.
And then their relationship...
where she essentially commits bestiality with him?
She does the sex with him basically because she feels sorry for him.
Right.
There is the implication that she has some kind of soft spot for him. Like, there's a part of her that likes him, but this is not, aside from like this implication, that's not elaborated on.
Well, and she says that like 90% of it was curiosity and boredom and pity.
But then he asks what the other 10% was, and she
answers by scratching him. As if she's like, no, the other part was me. I wanted to kill you. That was what I got from it.
I saw it as like, you know, oh God, I don't want to bring this up, but you know how, so in anime, there's the character archetype of the tsundere, you know, the hot cold where, you know, she likes him, but she also doesn't want to like admit that.
Okay.
So she treats him like garbage, and she's like, oh, it's not like I would go out with you or anything. And then she, you know, it's that kind of treatment. At least that's how I see it, where she's kind of in denial of a part of her liking him.
Sure.
Not that it helps me feel better, but...
Well, yeah, and at some point she basically said, look, if we were really getting down, you would be mortally wounded. Yeah. It's like a Klingon, you know, getting it on with a human, you know, it's dangerous.
Or with octopuses, apparently, but... certain...
I understand the reference.
Are really hardcore about it, but...
yeah.
I kind of... get that, where I kind of get the point that Liber's making, where he's trying to say that these cat people are above, like, just tangibly, demonstrably above humans in a certain way, in that sense at least, because otherwise, in terms of like ethics, in terms of like their sense of morals or even like intellectual bandwidth, they don't seem that different from humans. They've actually seem kind of worse, but yeah. They're convinced that they're so much higher than humans that we're basically like pets, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. That was really something.
It really was. I didn't like it.
No. And the part where he's like, hey, did last night not mean anything? And she's like, what? Haven't you ever jerked off a horse?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm glad you said it and not me, or else I would feel bad.
Well, she compares it to like using, you know, artificial animals, right?
Artificial insemination, I think it was the comparison, which is not the same thing, but okay.
No, but it was weird that it seemed like Liber wanted to position the space beatniks as very
good guys,
taboo bending and like noble for bending their society's mores, but then, you know, he stopped short of Tiger Ishka even being okay with the idea of same sex anything.
And also, they don't really, I mean, aside from saving Paul and the others, they don't really like redeem themselves. I know that, yeah. I guess that's kind of a weird way to put it, but basically, they don't prove that they're actually worthy of our respect.
Well, I mean, it'd be like someone, you know, crashing a car into your house. And then expecting you to defend them.
He's a rebel. He doesn't obey traffic laws.
Yeah, yeah.
He's built different.
And you know, they're supposed to be nigh on omniscient and immortal, and yet they didn't know that coming into this solar system that maybe don't go to the blue one.
Now maybe you shouldn't, you know, go near the single planet in the solar system that has life on it, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. There's so many inconsistencies. There are like so many questions that Liber does not answer. I have to think that he did not intend to take this seriously.
Maybe.
This had to be some kind of extended joke because, again, there's stuff that can only be explained with the rationale of it's pirating something. I don't know what, and I don't know if it's funny.
Yeah.
I actually looked up after I finished a few contemporary reviews because nowadays this is a pretty obscure and kind of scuffed book that no one wants to talk about. Mm-hmm. But back in the day, so I read, I think it was Avram Davidson's review in Fantasy and Science Fiction, Robert Silverberg in Amazing Stories, and P. Schuller Miller in Analog, and all three of them more or less liked it, which surprised me. I mean, they each had their own reasons, but they were basically like, oh yeah, this is a good time. And Miller even went so far as to say that eventually it may be considered a classic, which... no, that did not happen. It's been almost 60 years. It did not happen, but it's kind of a mystery because clearly this appealed to readers. I mean, it won the Hugo.
It did win the Hugo. I was just going to look up what the competition was.
The competition was not stiff. I know that. I remember off the top of my head, there was John Brunner's The Hole Man, which I haven't read. There was... Edgar Pangborn's Davy, which I actually did read earlier this year. I didn't love it, but it is easily a better novel than this. And I'm trying to remember what even else was nominated. It was not an all-star year.
Yeah, there was the Cordwainer Smith, The Planet Buyer.
The Planet Buyer, which would later become part of Nostralia. So it wasn't even like a complete novel at the time. But it's Cordwainer Smith, so it's probably better than The Wanderer.
Yeah.
But there's nothing that sticks out at me where I'm like, oh man, this was obviously snubbed, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, it's a weird one.
It's a weird one. So I'm thinking a big contribution to it winning was the fact that Liber, A, was a quarter century into his career. He debuted in 1939, pretty much hit the ground running with the first Fafford and Grey Mazur story. And even those early ones, they actually still read well. I would recommend them to people who are even remotely interested in adventure fantasy.
Okay.
But he was prolific for a time. Then he went away for a bit, partly because of the market, also because of some personal issues. Liber was weird. He either wrote a lot or nothing. If you looked at the years, I think it was like 1954 to 56, he literally did not put out anything. But then he came back, and the 60s were actually a pretty good time for him for the most part. He put out like six novels in the 60s, and he ended up winning like three or four Hugos for stuff other than The Wanderer, stuff that's actually pretty solid, like a Fafford and Grey Mazur story, like one of the darker ones. And one story of his Gonna Roll the Bones that was in Dangerous Visions, which I thought that one was pretty neat. And basically his standing with readers at the time was pretty solid. So I guess the fans at the time, the appeal was that A, it didn't take itself too seriously. And also it made references to kind of niche subcultures and like kind of what at the time would have been considered a counterculture stuff. Not hippie stuff exactly, but again, space beatniks. We've got the UFO Society, who are basically, decent characters, not characters, decent people, that Margot's with for so much of the novel. And we also have, of course, references. Actually, for much of the book, I kept track of like name drops because, of course, he name drops Heinlein. He name drops Edgar Rice Burroughs, which. Right. For like the kind of adventure planetary romance stuff, I guess makes sense. He also name drops Charles Fort, who was not a science fiction writer, but he wrote kind of weird books that are, I guess, technically nonfiction, but a lot of them were concerned with the paranormal and kind of the unexplained and ufology and that sort of thing, which makes sense with the UFO Society.
Yeah.
But again, you have references again, with the trio of stoners, because apparently Liber had discovered weed at some point. Right. and look, I'm not, as someone who enjoys the practice, I personally did not get much out of it, but maybe if I didn't read the whole thing sober.
Right.
Maybe I should have taken an edible before reading a few chapters. Maybe it would have hit different.
Maybe you could have gotten into the frame of mind where the ramrod he pretends that he's been like captured by UFOs before and is framing everything in terms of some prophecies about a wandering planet. It's just insufferable.
Oh my God. It's so not funny. I cannot. When he tries, Liber can be pretty funny, but not here. Mm-hmm. And when I was like reviewing a bunch of his short fiction and also the short novel Destiny Times Three some months ago, I kept remarking like, you know, it's actually hard for Liber to write a bad sentence, which I think even if you remember from The Big Time in Conjure Wife, on like a, you know, sheer prose level, those novels are pretty solid.
Yeah.
If kind of like on the quirky side. Mm-hmm. And it seems like with The Wanderer, he challenged himself to write bad sentences.
One of the things I was just noticing looking down the list of characters is the way the book refers to characters by about three different names apiece, at least for some of them, because you have the point where, is it Margot and Paul that nickname everybody?
I think so. Or at least Margot, but,
yeah. So then like the professor Ross Hunter, sometimes referred to as Ross, sometimes as Hunter, sometimes as Beardy. You have Doc, and then he's also known by his actual name. Brecht, and it to me it just got confusing.
With the UFO people, sometimes they're called by their nicknames, sometimes they're called by their actual names, and it's like I don't care enough to memorize all this.
That sounds about right. Yeah,
it's so frustrating because I went into this novel knowing that Liber was capable of so much better, and that he usually was like usually he did better. I can't say I was disappointed because I went into it expecting it to be bad,
mm-hmm.
but still it was kind of like dismaying. And then we get to the stuff with Paul and Tigerishka, and I can feel the life energy like sap from my body.
I mean, to me, like the most interesting part of the book was when Tigerishka finally fesses up that, yes, okay, indeed, we are afraid of something.
We're on the run from something. But
and that was interesting, and it was a good monologue. And like I went back and reread the chapter. I had listened to that chapter on the audiobook, and I was like, okay, I want to go back and listen or and read that one. And that was all fascinating. It was kind of cool universe building, but it wasn't worth the rest of the book.
It's one of those, like I said earlier, it's like one of those little glimmers of actual good writing buried in parts of the novel that aren't worth it ultimately.
Yeah.
But it's a painful reminder that Liber can actually write well.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else you want to talk about the actual book?
Okay, so I'm not sure if this is going to be in the recording. I think it was pre-recording, but I brought up that this novel, which again is pretty obscure, I'm not even sure if it's in print right now. I think it might have. I know it has an ebook edition from.
It does.
Open Road Media, which mm-hmm. always fills me with dread, but. With those guys, but it has been reprinted quite often, and the edition on the Internet Archive, at least the first one that comes up, it's a Penguin edition from the 70s, and the cover is kind of not safe for work. It's of Tigerishka, who, again, these are cat people in the sense that they are basically, they don't wear clothes, right? I can't describe it, but on the edition that I have, which is a tour paperback from 1983, this cover really sucks. It looks like Paul hovering, like he's being held up by a circle in front of a giant. It looks like a lion, like a kind of lion with woman's eye, like human woman's eyes. It's very weird.
Yeah. Do yourself a favor, listener, go ahead and do an image search on The Wanderer Fritz Liber cover.
Because there are quite a few covers and most of them are not good, but
no.
This particular one, there's the moon that apparently is still in one piece in the background, and the tagline reads, though she destroy his world, still he must love her. M-dash.
Yeah.
Which is misleading, because before I started reading, I thought that, like, it makes it sound like Tigerishka keeps Paul as, like, a sex slave.
Kind of does, doesn't it?
When in reality, it's almost like the reverse, where she kind of just, like, wants to be rid of him. But, like, he's really into that.
There's some pretty PG-13 or R-rated covers of this book.
Yeah, there are, like, one or two, I would say, R-rated covers, which... I guess fits. Oh, wait, there's something at the top. It's above Fritz Leiber's name. It says, "A Novel of Alien Domination" by Fritz Leiber. Which I don't know if I would call it domination. Passive destruction. But that doesn't sound as good.
Yeah, because they're, you know, it's not like they're coming to Earth to enslave, like, Earth in any way.
Like, right? Intentionally.
They really have just, we want some resources.
Yeah, they really have no interest in, like, you know, farming humans or keeping slaves or whatever. They just want to, like, use up the natural resources, and they do not care who, you know, has to be sacrificed for it.
Yeah, yeah.
The back cover...
Another one kind of has a cool flying saucer, and it shows... It's actually a pretty cool cover. Maybe I'll download this one and use it for the...
I think I know what one you're... Is it the one with, like, the ship that's, like, in a tidal wave...
Yeah.
It's like a tsunami. Okay, I think I know the one. Yeah, that's actually a decent one.
And the Wanderer is in the background, and it you know, it's pretty purple and yellow, and that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it makes sense. The back cover reads, "For 5 billion human beings, reaction to the arrival of the Wanderer," the is capitalized,
right,
"is pure and simple, stark terror as the alien planet's presence causes ever more terrible catastrophes. Mm-hmm. But for one man, it is different. For him, the story of the Wanderer is one of bizarre alien domination, merging into unrequited love for she who owns him." It makes it sound erotic. It also makes it sound like a single cohesive narrative as opposed to an ensemble.
Yeah.
Sounds like a better book in a way.
It does. I was trying to encapsulate this to somebody the other day, and I said, it's like there's a good, like, novelette's worth of interesting story here, and then there's a whole bunch of other stuff around the outside that doesn't serve the central narrative, and there really isn't a central narrative because of that.
Yeah. And granted, you could say the same thing about Stand on Zanzibar, but mm-hmm. there is I think a subtle shifting in priorities where clearly the, like, context and tracking with close-ups, the chapters that don't directly push the plot forward are really the meat of the book.
Right. They're interesting too.
And they're interesting. They're often they're quirky. They're pretty readable. They're short. And the plot is there because there has to be a plot.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like Leiber, he came up with a plot. Okay. But for some reason, he thought that it was not good enough to relegate it to a short story or a novella, or even like a novel that'd be 200 pages that could appear in some magazine. So he instead figures that maybe he could get paid more if he wrote, like, a 300-page novel. It doesn't feel like 300 pages. Mm-hmm. Well, for one, it's in small type. I don't know if, like, if your edition has, like, this little type that was made for ants, but that's kind of my edition. So, again, it feels longer than it is.
Yeah. Mine, I was reading the ebook, and so it was, you know, the print was exactly how big I needed it to be at my age.
Yeah, I read on... desktop. I actually don't have, like, a Kindle or you know, something to read ebooks, and I can't really listen to audiobooks either. Maybe it's the attention span. I just can't deal. Like, I have a hard enough time retaining information when reading, and I have, like, an even harder time when listening, because I'll have, like, these blackout periods. Right.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Big time. That's a reason that for me, I don't usually consider audiobook listening the same as reading in print, just because I know I don't take it in the same way.
I mean, you literally don't process it the same way. I know that's not something that some people want to hear, but it is fundamentally a different experience. Mm-hmm. Which is to not, you know, that's not to say that you didn't really read the novel. You listened to someone narrating, and that's different. It's different, but it still counts.
Sure.
You know, you experienced the book just in a slightly different form.
Yeah. And there's an effort factor too for me where I feel like I have to discount it if I just listen to it. But there's also times where I think if I have to read this one on my own, I'm going to give up the will to continue going with the podcast. So I'm going to just do this one on audio.
Yeah. Yeah. Roma. I guess it was for the best. At least this was not the last one. It's one of the last, but at least it is not the last novel covered here. That would be terrible.
Well, here we go. So how about we try and end this on a positive thing? You know, if somebody's interested in reading Fritz Leiber, but they maybe have been scared away from this book and are still listening at this point for some reason, what are some other recommendations for other Leiber that you would say? And it doesn't have to be novel.
So as far as novels, again, I'd recommend The Big Time. The Change War series, which it's a part of, is pretty interesting. I actually read the short story, Try and Change the Past, which is another, it's set in that same setting, that was published simultaneously with The Big Time. It's short, it's snappy, it's kind of eerie. I mean, the title alone gives like a hint of fatalism about it. You can actually read it free, totally legit, on the Library of America's Story of the Week site, which is kind of, you know, they usually publish like classic, reprint classic stories there, but occasionally they also reprint science fiction, and that's one of them. So that story is actually a pretty good starting place if you're curious. And also, if you lean towards fantasy, obviously the Fafhrden Greymaster, adventure stories, which are mostly pretty episodic if you can find, collections of them, because they're in different volumes. And again, mostly it's short fiction that I recommend, because Leiber, even though he won two Hugos, well, three, actually, for best novel, he wasn't that much of a novelist.
Mm. Okay.
So, and again, I know that with Leiber, for you, that you've read, I assume you've only read what you've covered for the podcast. So your experience with Leiber has been basically fine novel that's kind of silly, Conjure Wife, and bad novel.
Yeah. The thing with Conjure Wife was like, I felt like it wasn't super serious, and that made it fun.
Yeah, that's not a novel that you're supposed to take like super literally. It clearly runs on its own logic.
You know, The Wanderer, the experience of reading The Wanderer reminded me of my experience with the Kim Stanley Robinson Mars series, where there's stuff happening, but it's happening to characters that I just can't really connect with.
Oh yeah, I was actually going to bring that up. I forgot, but then you reminded me, because I did read Red Mars years ago, and I actually liked Red Mars.
Okay.
But when I got to Green Mars, for some reasons, I don't know what it was. Maybe it was just like the cast of characters that was in that novel, but it was a chore. I couldn't, I haven't read Blue Mars because I didn't like Green Mars.
It's more the same.
It's more, oh yeah, I can believe it. Yeah, it's kind of like that.
I mean, I usually give a slight edge to a final book in a series for having the virtue to finish the series. Not my favorites.
Yeah. So I'm curious, cause those were at the very bottom of your ranking.
Yeah.
For the Hugo winners. Where does The Wanderer fall?
I'll have to look.
You have to think about it.
It's going to be pretty far down there.
Down.
It's funny because I was looking at the list the other day and, you know, trying to fit something onto it. And I'm like, okay, this is like in 68th place, but I liked that book. Right. And so like,
well, there aren't many, I mean,
there aren't many absolute duds.
There are a couple Hugo winners that I've read that I didn't like. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't like Red Shirts.
Okay.
And I didn't like Green Mars. Like I said, they're not bad books. Mm-hmm. The Wanderer is a bad book.
Yeah.
I'm pretty confident in saying that. So for me, it might actually be at the bottom, but I also haven't read all of the Hugo winners. So.
Yeah. I look over it and it like from 70 on down, they're just like either books that didn't have much to them or ones that just didn't quite work for me. But, and The Wanderer is going to be somewhere in there, I'm sure. You know, coming into doing the podcast, I had heard They'd Rather Be Right is the worst one.
That ended up not being the case for you.
Not for me. Yeah, it worked pretty well for me. And it was one of those ones where, like my guest said, it's a novel of a single idea. If you're interested in the idea, the novel then works.
But it's also a novel and not a short story.
Exactly. Yeah.
Actually, I do want to cover it at some point because it was serialized. It was, you know, it was published in Astounding, so it's perfectly eligible for my site. To write about, maybe suffer through, I don't know.
Nice. Well, we'll see how your experience is with it. Because you know, that's the thing, right? Nobody ever reads the same book.
Especially going, you know, going from reading a book in as like a single unit, which we had to do with The Wonder, versus reading it in multiple parts.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You can't necessarily recapture what it was like to read a book that was in serialization when you read it all bound up together.
Yeah. It reads different.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of like the binge model of television versus like the water cooler stuff that you get when something releases week to week.
Yeah. Yeah. It would take months for a novel to be published in its entirety. And, you know, people would write to the editor and there would be a letters column of people giving their thoughts on it as it progressed.
Yeah. Yeah. That would have been an interesting time to be around, you know, to actually have gone through that, the kind of the formation of fandom.
Yeah. Maybe if we were alive, then we could understand why people like The Wanderer. Cause clearly that's kind of hard to do now. But Liber's done way better. You know, if for some reason, you, the listener, if you pick up the Wonder, you haven't read any Liber before, just be aware that he's not a bad author. You happen to be catching him at a very bad time.
Yeah.
And you know, bad first impression with a good author, that an author that you might end up liking, that can like really hurt the reading experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd be curious if there's anybody out there who's like, hey, I really enjoyed that novel. I would love to hear from you, because, you know, I'm not going to tell you you're wrong, because people like things for different reasons.
I'd be very really curious.
Like, yeah, because I know that, like, you know, the Mars series, the ones that I despised, there are people who absolutely love them, and more power to them. I'm glad. Just like, you know, this book is a cat book, and Fritz Leiber is clearly a cat person. You know, have at it. If you like cats, great.
If you
make a cat novel, I'm probably not going to like it.
If you like, how do I put this?
If you love cats, but you don't love cats.
If you like cats a little too much, you may like this book.
Yeah.
If you're okay. I'm not going to go too far. I've been well behaved.
You have.
I've kept the language PG, which is remarkable. Again, I'm from Jersey. I'm used to being much more salty than this. But yeah, that's The Wanderer. It's not good, but I am kind of glad I read it in a way to be here, but also because now I know that Liber, an author I really like, he is capable of, you know, doing bad.
Yeah.
Now I know.
Yep. Well, I think that'll probably suffice for final thoughts. So I want to say thank you for coming on and doing this, and for helping me check this one off. It's always fun to just sort of have a little bit of a therapy session after a book sometimes.
Oh yeah, I've been itching to talk about this because I finished the novel like a month ago, and I'm like, oh, has Seth even read it yet? Does he know?
Yeah. Yeah, you had put in our conversation like, at this point, I just want to get it over with.
Yeah. Now it's over, and this is actually the first time that I've been on like an SF podcast.
Well, there you go.
With anybody, which is crazy.
Perfect. Well, I'm quite happy to be your first podcast host. I think this was a lot of fun. It was great talking to you, great meeting you.
Yeah, great. Yeah, first time to be a guest on someone's podcast, especially someone that whose work I've liked before, right?
Well, before we sign off, where can people find you?
So, I'm mostly active on Twitter. You can find me at, I believe it's BDCollins_1995, which I know, very inventive, the year of my birth. I'm also occasionally on Mastodon.
Okay.
BDCollins, it would be at BDCollins at wandering.shop. I occasionally post there. It's basically just reposts, from Twitter about my site. Of course, my site, Remembrance of Things Past and Future, you can find at sffremembrance.com. And if you're curious for some reason about my takes on film and occasionally TV, I also have a Letterboxd. That I have actually linked to on, I know, on my site and at least on Mastodon. So,
okay, cool. I'll look you up. I have one of those as well.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well, I'll make sure to get all your links and put them in the show notes. And I want to thank you again for doing this. And, you know, I'm sure we'll interact down the line at some point.
In the future.
Yep.
All right.
All right. Take care.
Yeah, you too.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Brian. I thought that was a lot of fun, even though neither of us really liked the book. That just, it happens sometimes. And I'm glad that I've covered it. And that was the penultimate episode of the main list that I'm covering here. So my next episode will be on The Snow Queen. And that's one that I'm planning on doing. I'm not going to give up my guess just in case it falls through. But I'm deep into planning what I'm going to be doing with this space after I finish the list. And I've got thoughts and ideas, and I've also gotten some good feedback from folks who have filled out the survey that I sent out. It's my pinned tweet on Twitter. I'll keep it there for this episode probably. And then I'm going to be starting to do some recording on what I'm going to do in the future. I'm also going to do an Ask Me Anything episode based on some of the stuff that has come in through that survey. So if you have an Ask Me Anything kind of question, burning question for me, find it there in the pinned tweet. Fill out the form if you want to. Or you can just contact me, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or tweet at me @hugospodcast. I also, of course, still have Take Me to Your Reader, which is another science fiction-based podcast that I do with my friends James and Colin. I think it's a lot of fun. Can't remember if we mentioned it on this one or on the last bonus episode that I did. We've been doing that since 2014. So there's a lot of content if you're into science fiction movies adapted from books. Lots of stuff to enjoy there. If you want to support the work that I do on this podcast, on Tech Meteor Reader and Brief and Not So Brief, you can go over to patreon.com/hugospodcast and sign up to support there. And if you want to promote this podcast in any way, you know how to do it. Share it on social media. Tell people about it. At any rate, regardless of if you share on social media or support on Patreon, thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. And I will talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.